This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 1 Kings. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in 1 Kings chapter 4 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Well, tonight we're in 1 Kings chapter 4. The 80 years that David and his son Solomon reigned over Israel were considered the golden age of Hebrew history. In the world at large, Homer was writing poetry in Greece. The dawning of Greek civilization had just begun. Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon, the traditional world powers, were in a state of decline. So at the time, Israel was the most powerful nation on earth, the world's lone superpower. Solomon ruled over literally a global empire. He built alliances and he entered into trade agreements with foreign kings that brought about unprecedented wealth to the nation of Israel. He built a navy and a merchant marine. He opened up Israel to world markets and in the process spread his fame and reputation to the ends of the earth. David had won the battles and had established the dynasty. Solomon took it to the next level. He expanded the kingdom and God used him to make Israel great. Tonight we're going to take a look at the achievements of King Solomon. Well, chapter 4 begins. So King Solomon was king over Israel, and these were his officials. And the first 19 verses list the members of Solomon's administration. Azariah, the son of Zadok, the priest. And this was an important office because the high priest spoke for God. Elihoreph and Ahiah, the sons of Shisha, were scribes, or literally the secretaries of state, Condoleezza Rice and so forth. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, the recorder, or the state historian. And in those days, this was an important job because this was the man who managed the king's legacy. What history would know of the king was in his hands. There was no media, there was no press, and so the official records of the state were those that were left to the future and to history. You could compare this guy to the president's press secretary. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, you remember him from last week, he was the guy that kept killing everybody, you know, the executioner. He was over the army, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right here. The highest ranking military officer was Benaiah. Remember, he replaced General Joab. And of course, this was a promotion for Benaiah. He served under David as the head of the FBI, the Cherethites and the Pelethites. You remember that? Those were his secret service. And so this is a promotion now for Benaiah. Well, Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. And Abiathar is included here because he was Zadok's predecessor. Well, Azariah, the son of Nathan, over the officers. This was the equivalent of the White House chief of staff. He managed the king's schedule and agenda and contacts. Zabud, the son of Nathan, a priest, and he was the king's friend. Isn't that something? You remember the prophet Nathan had been a wise confidant for David, and so Solomon became friends with his son Zabud. Ahishar over the household. He ran the king's family affairs. And Adoniram, the son of Abda, over the labor force. He was in charge of the slave labor that Solomon had accumulated and the guilds of craftsmen that he employed in many of his building projects. Verse 7 tells us, and Solomon had 12 governors over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each one made provision for 1 month of the year. These are their names. Ben-Hur. I bet you didn't know Charlton Heston lived back then. In the mountains of Ephraim, Ben-Deker. In Makaz, Shalbim, Beth-Shemesh, and Elon, Beth-Hanan. Ben-Hesed in Aruboth, not Aruba, but Aruboth. To him belonged Succo and all the land of Hefer. Ben-Abinadab, son of Abinadab. That's what Ben means. In all the regions of Dor, he had Tophath, the daughter of Solomon, as wife. Ben-Abinadab was the king's son-in-law. And you can bet Solomon had his eye on him. Ben had married a princess. You know, there's an old saying, marry a girl whose daddy calls her a princess, and you're going to have to treat her like a queen. Be careful. This king's little girl, this was the king's little girl. She may have been a spoiled brat. Here's why I say that. It's interesting that in the Hebrew, the name Tophath means a dropping of ointment. Now, that could be a good thing, a perfume. It could also mean a drip, which could mean a bad thing. And maybe Solomon was thinking of his poor son-in-law, Ben Abinadab, when he penned Proverbs chapter 27, verse 15. You know what it says? You guys know what it says. A continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Both kinds of drips can get on your nerves and drive you a little nutso. And so, marrying a girl named Drippy. Verses 12 through 19 continue this list of governors whose names I cannot pronounce and their jurisdictions. And so I'll let you read their names, perhaps put you to sleep tonight. These were the revenue agents, though, who collected taxes for Solomon and the central government. Each man was responsible for the king's support for 1 month. It's interesting that these 12 divisions were not along tribal territories. And this is interesting. For some reason, Solomon divided the kingdom along non-traditional lines. And you know, that really isn't a bad idea from time to time. In essence, the king was trying to reshuffle the deck, break up a few unhealthy cliques that had gotten started, form a new friendships and alliances. This is often needed in the church. Isn't it amazing how we tend to gravitate toward the people that we already know and like? Times we need to be forced to reach out to new folks to create new bonds. When was the last time you went out of your way to say hello to someone that you didn't recognize? Try to create a new friend here at your own church. This was a good idea by the king. He kind of reshuffled the deck and structured new boundaries. Verse 20. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. A golden age. An age of prosperity, a time of plenty. In all of Israel, in the north, or Israel in the south, or Judah. So Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms from the river. That is the Euphrates, not just the Jordan. He reigned from all the way the Euphrates back in Iraq, all the way across to the plain of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. And they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now Solomon's provision for one day, now catch this. You talk about living high on the, well, he didn't live high on the hog. He was a Jew, but you talk about living high on the hog. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal. A core consists of about 55 gallons. Now imagine every morning a man pulling up in the bread truck, pulling up to Solomon's dock at the royal kitchen with 30 55-gallon drums of fine flour, another 60 55-gallon drums packed with meal or crushed grain. Evidently, the king and his court, man, they like to eat. Chowing down was a core activity in the household. Well, in addition to the bread, each day they ordered 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. Solomon was no vegetarian, no, no. This was a meat and bread kind of man. Steak and ribs and lamb chops and barbecued venison and turkey and pheasant and duck. Oh my, this reminds me. I went to the pastor's conference 1 year out in California, and these pastors from Michigan took me to a place. They made me go. They took me to a place called the Brazilian Steakhouse. Have you ever heard of it? Oh, my. They made me go. You sit down at the table, and all of a sudden the waiter starts. You don't order anything. The waiter just starts bringing out various types of meat. They bring the meat out on a spit and just sort of put it on top of the table, and they literally shave it off the bone right there in front of you and serve you one cut of meat after another. Oh, it's incredible. I ate that night until it hurt. Evidently, though, this is what went on every single night in Solomon's house, around his table. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river. Again, the Euphrates, from Tifsa, a city which is on the west bank of the Euphrates in what would today be Syria, even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river. And he had peace on every side all around him. What a difference between him and our day. He had peace all around him. Today, Israel finds opponents and warmongers all around them. David had conquered these kings. He had won the victories, but Solomon was left to enjoy the peace that followed. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. Dan was the northernmost boundary in Israel. Beersheba was the southern border of Israel. And so this expression, from Dan to Beersheba, is the equivalent of us saying from north to south. All the land enjoyed peace under Solomon. And notice this expression, each man under his vine and his fig tree. This became sort of a proverbial picture of peace and prosperity. Everybody under their vine, under their fig tree. Every man just sort of kicked back under his fig tree. In the shade, laying on his hammock, sipping some sweet tea, not a care in the world. Life is good. That was the picture under Solomon's reign. You know, it's interesting, this phrase, every man under his vine and his fig tree, is used again several places. Isaiah 36, verse 16, Micah 4, verse 4, Zechariah 3, verse 10. In fact, in Israel's difficult days, this phrase will be used prophetically of the end of the age, when the Prince of Peace will return to this earth and establish his kingdom. In that day, when Jesus reigns over the earth, every man will sit under his vine and under his fig tree in the shade and enjoy an age of peace and prosperity. Messiah will usher in a global peace. Micah 4 tells us this, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. Join with me as we say, come quickly, Lord Jesus. Yes. Verse 26. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots. He did a lot of horsing around, didn't he? And 12,000 horsemen. You know, when we go to Israel, we always visit Megiddo. And there you can see Solomon's stables where he used to keep this incredible herd of horses. Actually kept them in several locations in Jerusalem and really all around his kingdom. And these governors, each man in his month, provided food for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table. There was no lack in their supply. They also brought barley and straw to the proper place for the horses and steeds, each man according to his charge. They fed both Solomon and his cavalry. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. What a combination we find in this man, Solomon. He was compassionate and kind as well as wise and understanding. Here's a man with a rare combination, a quick mind and a big heart. You know, most people are just the opposite. They're stubborn and they're stingy. They're narrow-minded and they're small-hearted. Solomon, though, he had an open mind. And he had this big, large heart for people. Solomon ruled with his head and with his heart. Verse 30 tells us, thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. Recognize any of those guys? No. Recognize Solomon? Yes. That's because Solomon was smarter than all those guys. Actually, Ethan, you should recognize, he wrote Psalm 89, one psalm. Heman wrote Psalm 88. The other men, we know nothing about, but they were apparently wise guys in their day. Notice this about Solomon. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs, talk about a prolific songwriter. His songs were 1,005. That's a lot of hits. Wonder how many made the top 40 or the top 10 or went platinum. The book of Proverbs contains roughly 750 proverbs. That means we only have 25% of Solomon's proverbs. And of his 1,005 songs, you know how many we have? We got three. Psalm 72, Psalm 127, and the Song of Solomon are Solomon's songs. I guess we're going to have to wait until heaven to read the complete works of King Solomon. Well, look too at verse 33. Also, he spoke of trees. The guy was into trees. From the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. In other words, these huge, colossal, you know, stately trees, the cedars of Lebanon, all the way down to the little moss that grows out of the cracks in the sidewalk that you kind of stump and rub your foot over to get them out of the cracks and all, you know. Solomon was an expert in it all. He spoke also of animals and birds and of creeping insects. He was into insects. He was into bugs and even fish. Solomon was a student of science. He was a botanist and a zoologist. Verse 34 says, "And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon." The king of Israel had become a tourist attraction. Wise men from all over the world would journey to Jerusalem to match wits with the wisest king who had ever lived. In chapter 5, Solomon prepares to build the temple. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon because he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father. For Hiram, he had always loved David. They'd had a good relationship. Then Solomon sent to Hiram saying, "You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord because of the wars which were fought against him on every side until the Lord put his foes under the soles of his feet." You remember the blood David shed, the wars that David led, the hostilities that David fed, that's what disqualified him from constructing the building that God intended as a place of peace, the temple. David had been prohibited from building the temple. The task had been inherited by Solomon. And here he recruits Hiram's help. "But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor evil occurrence. And behold, I propose to build a house for the name of the Lord my God." And notice this language. He's not building a house for God. He's building a house for the name of the Lord my God. You see, a pagan temple was built with the intention of housing the God himself. In other words, the idol became the occupant. But Solomon knew that the true God, the God of Israel, the Almighty God, could be contained in no earthly structure. God holds the heavens in his hand. How can he fit into a house? In one of his songs, Psalm 72, Solomon writes, "Blessed be his glorious name forever, and let the whole earth be filled with his glory." Solomon knew that Jehovah God fills the universe. This temple was not built to inhabit God. This temple was built as a place to declare his name. "And as the Lord spoke to my father David, saying, 'Your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, he shall build the house for my name.'" And here Solomon is just quoting God's promise that he made to David that Solomon would build the temple. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12. Now his conversation with Hiram continues. "Now therefore, command that they cut down cedars for me from Lebanon." I think we got a picture. There's one of those stately cedars from up in Lebanon. "Made great wood." It was the wood that they used to build the temple. And so he gets this wood from Hiram. And my servants will be your servants, and I will pay you wages for your servants according to whatever you say. For you know there is none among us who has skill to cut timber like the Sidonians. And of course, Tyre and Sidon, you know where they are on the map. They're up north of Israel, up in what is today Lebanon, over on the coast. And so it was, when Hiram heard the words of Solomon, that he rejoiced greatly and said, "Blessed be the Lord this day, for he has given David a wise son over this great people." And it's interesting that God used Gentiles to help the Hebrews build their temple. Hiram helped a Gentile. This was forgotten by later Jews who grew to hate the Gentiles. Then Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, "I have considered the message which you sent me, and I will do all you desire concerning the cedar and cypress logs. My servant shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea, and I will float them in rafts by sea to the place you indicate to me, and will have them broken apart there. Then you can take them away, and you shall fulfill my desire by giving food for my household." And so he'll ship them down by sea, by raft, along the coast there to probably Joppa, Tel Aviv, and then they transported them up to Jerusalem. Notice the men of Tyre worked tirelessly for Solomon. And all they ask as a form of payment is a little food. And as we've already seen, Solomon had plenty to spare. Then Hiram gave Solomon cedar and cypress logs according to all his desire. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household and 20 cores of pressed oil. Thus Solomon gave to Hiram year by year. So the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he had promised him, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty together. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel, and the labor force was 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They were 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. And this was wise. He was looking out for his men. You know, they needed to spend a little time away from home, but not too much time. They needed to come back home to their wives and their kids, and so they worked out of three. Adoniram was in charge of the labor force. Solomon had 70,000 who carried burdens and 80,000 who quarried stones in the mountains, besides 3,300 from the chiefs of Solomon's deputies who supervised the people who labored in the work. The whole workforce that labored on the temple numbered 183,300 men. You remember in the days of David, the men of Israel were preoccupied with battle. It required a period of peace in order to free up the manpower that would be needed for construction. Well, verse 17 tells us, "And the king commanded them to quarry large stones, costly stones, and hewn or engraved stones to lay the foundation of the temple." Now, whenever we go to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, you see these enormous stones that were used by the Romans in the rebuilding of the temple in 40 BC. These stones that we see in Jerusalem today obviously came later than the stones of Solomon's day, but they do kind of give you a picture of how large these stones must have been. In fact, Solomon's stones may have even been larger. You can see, just to the right of Yuval, you can see this is one stone that runs all the way down almost to the end of that corridor. One solid stone. I forget how many tons the stone weighs, but it's an enormous, colossal stone. So when you read here that the king quarried large stones, believe me, he did. These were huge, huge stones. So Solomon's builders, Hiram's builders, and the Gebalites quarried them, and they prepared timber and stones to build the temple.
In today's message, Pastor Sandy continued through the book of 1 Kings. With life accelerating at a seemingly endless rate, it's easy to find yourself turning towards technology for your own routine, for support. You know in your heart that God has provided for you all along, but almost involuntarily, you begin to replace Him with things of this world. King Solomon serves as a reminder to you that when your focus on God blurs and you rely on the things of this world instead, your fate is sealed. King Solomon fell when he depended on his wealth and status instead of God who had blessed him. Take time right now to thank God every day for His blessings. You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. Pastor Sandy comes to us from Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain, located in Atlanta, Georgia. Are you in the area or will you be passing by sometime soon? We would love to see you on a Sunday morning at 9:15 or 11:15. For more information, head over to our website, sandyadams.org, and select the About tab. Once again, that website is sandyadams.org. Pastor Sandy brings sound biblical teaching as he goes through the Bible verse by verse. You'll hear the truth loud and clear and learn how to stick to that truth when others around you stray. We're so glad you decided to spend your time with us here today. That's all we have for now, but be sure to come back again for more on Sandy Adams Radio.